Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and you know by now that I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the immense privilege of speaking with Ambassador Tim Davis. Ambassador Davis most recently served as the U.S. Ambassador to Qatar. Prior to his confirmation, he served as Executive Assistant to Secretaries of State Pompeo and Blinken. He also served as U.S. Consul General in Basra, Iraq. He had other overseas tours, including Guatemala City, Iraq, Australia, Colombia, and his domestic assignments included Senior Watch Officer in the State Department Ops Center and Special Assistant to Secretary of State Clinton, Director for Iraq at the National Security Council, Deputy Chief of Staff to the Special Presidential Envoy to Counter ISIL, so many other roles, and I can tell that you've been pretty busy over the years. So now that you're 5 minutes into retirement, I'm so happy to have you here with me today. So welcome, Ambassador. Thank you for being here to talk with us.
Thanks, Kate. It's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I want to go all the way back to the beginning, like we always do on this show, and talk about your family and how all of that inspired this incredible career of service that you've embarked upon. So where did you grow up? And tell me about your family.
Yeah, so we'll do that in reverse order. Because my family informs where I grew up. My father and mother were raised in South Mississippi. My dad was drafted in 1966 into the Marine Corps for Vietnam, served two tours, a couple of Purple Hearts, came home from Vietnam and got out of the Marine Corps. He was home for a month working at a meatpacking plant in Jackson, Mississippi. And a couple of Marines from the reserve station came by and they were grabbing some chicken for a cookout they were going to have. He saw them in their uniform. He went home that day and he told my mom, "I'm getting back in the Marine Corps."
Wow.
And then went on to serve another 28 years in the Marine Corps. And so my two sisters and I grew up on Marine Corps bases. I was born at Quantico, just down the road from D.C., and graduated from Camp Lejeune High School in North Carolina, and so spent my formative years around service and around the Marine Corps.
Yeah, so then did you ever consider another path for yourself, or did you, because we'll talk about this, but you ended up also joining the military, and we'll talk about that service. Did you ever consider that you would do something totally different, or was it kind of just like written in the stars for you?
I considered everything except the Marine Corps. My friends and I were certain that the one thing we were not going to do was join the Marine Corps. My best friend and I were going to pursue all kinds of other things, psychology, law. And then a few years after we graduated from high school, we were both in the Marine Corps. And so I guess it was written in the stars. I tried to avoid my fate for a little while, but ultimately, the best thing I ever did was join the United States Marine Corps.
Yeah. What were some of the highlights from that service? Because maybe some of our listeners aren't familiar with what it's like to serve in the Marine Corps. So what would you say were the highlights of that journey?
I mean, I think the biggest thing that I got from the Marine Corps was camaraderie. It's the smallest of the services and only about 170,000 U.S. Marines. And you are taught from day one how unique that is. Mostly, I think they do that because we're not going to get equipment as good as the Air Force or the Army, and so they want you to feel special when you're trying to fight wars with the equipment that the Army and the Air Force no longer need. You know, every day in the Marine Corps, Ronald Reagan said, most people live lives where they wonder if they've made a difference in the world. Marines don't have that problem. And so it was extraordinary and it was hard and it began on day one being difficult. And there are no easy ways into a career in the Marine Corps. There are no easy ways up in the Marine Corps. It is all a grind. And then you deploy together and you go on Marine Expeditionary Units together. And some of the funniest things you could ever imagine happen because you're just hanging out and trying to make the most of your time. And then some of the toughest things that ever happened. And so you become sort of bonded for life in the Marine Corps. One of the things that when I joined the State Department, I was shocked by was on the weekends in the State Department, you can just go do whatever you want.
Yeah.
In the Marine Corps, it's 24/7. You do have a weekend, but you've got to tell three people where you're going and you've got to to stay inside a certain radius, and you're subject to recall at any moment. And so the Marine Corps is all consuming as a profession, but it also is rewarding in ways that are hard to identify going into.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so now I'm picturing you like early in your first State Department assignment, just circling Main State on the weekends, waiting to be called into the building.
Kate, I one of my first ambassadors in Canberra, in Australia, I still had a little bit of Marine Corps in me. Uh-huh. And finally, one day he came out of his office. I was sitting outside his office and he said, Tim, he said, I love you. You got to stop showing up to my office 15 minutes early for meetings. He said, you're making me really nervous. And yeah. I said, OK. He said, in the State Department, mm-hmm. we show up on time.
On
for
time
meetings.
Is on time. But military, right. Early is on time. Right?
Early is on time. And so he disabused me of that. But there were all those sorts of things along the way that I had to learn humbly.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a little different because normally I only ask people to analyze their own why for public service, but you said something interesting to me when we first chatted before this call about your family's history and why you think maybe your family might have been invested in service, why your dad might have chosen to go back into the Marines and felt such a strong pull there. So would you mind for a minute if we contextualize your service journey within your family's broader history with this country?
My dad's a Marine, my uncles mm-hmm. are Marines, my sister and her husband are Marines. And so there are a couple of generations of Marines in our family. I mean, for us, my father was born into a sharecropping family in Mississippi in 1943. He missed school in the fall every year, bringing in a harvest that did not enrich the family in any way, but allowed them to survive. In a lot of ways, what we owe this country, what we owe the opportunity is service, to dedicate parts of our lives and making the most of the opportunity to serve, to be part of what makes the United States such a miraculous form of government, such a miraculous entity in the world. We want to be part of that. And some of that comes from how hard it was for my parents growing up. And part of it comes from the example set over the years by people who chose service mm-hmm. over enrichment. And mm-hmm. so for our family, serving, whether it be the Marine Corps, the State Department, or any place else, my older sister is a nurse in Birmingham, Alabama. For us, it's an obligation because for us to be able to, we feel, enjoy the fruits of all of the promise of the United States, it takes a contribution by us at every level.
That's so beautiful and a really powerful message at this moment for public servants. And a lot of our audience is still public servants who are listening in and listening to their friends and colleagues. And I think it's important to remember that there are a lot of different ways to serve and that we're thinking about our service in this project, not just in the context of our own careers, but in the context of our broader family story, our country's story. And so when you think of it that way, it's easier than to imagine what other potential futures can be out there for you if it's a continuation of an investment in not only your own growth and development and curiosity, but also the bigger project of our country. So I love that you think about it that way.
Look, I appreciate that. We all enjoy the fruits of mm-hmm. Of the United States and of the guarantees on our citizenship and freedom. And so I know that my family, we're just proud to be part of a group of people who've said, how can I help pay back?
Yeah, that's amazing. So since you've done so many different things and paid back in so many ways, why don't you tell me about a couple of highlights? Like, what were some of your coolest days on the job in any of your capacities?
Wow. Well,
you've had so many cool days. You met the Pope. I'm talking to someone who met the Pope.
Listen, And when I met the Pope, because I've been so lucky in this job, I think we talked about the idea of privilege. The State Department has allowed me to do everything. I have gotten to be in extraordinary rooms and see extraordinary things. And, but it's not always serious. When I met the Pope, I speak Spanish, and obviously Pope Francis, the late Pope Francis spoke Spanish, and so we were speaking in Spanish. And when I was leaving, I said, Vaya con Dios, and he just kind of looked at me like, yeah, that's what I do. I go with God. I don't need you to tell me to do that. I've been lucky enough to meet Jimmy Carter. You know, I worked overnight when we were evacuating Libya, when I was working for Secretary Clinton. I closed our consulate in Basra in southern Iraq under fire. I have just had extraordinary moments. In the early days of our counter ISIS effort, General Allen brought me up from Bogota to work with him on that. It hasn't all been bright, right? There are some truly tragic moments. If you look at my bio, served in Iraq 3 times, one of those in Najaf, 2005, 2007. There was so much loss, and so many of my decisions led to, the loss of life. I carry that with me in highs and lows. Yeah. The State Department has given me every possible opportunity.
Yeah, and so that is a heavy weight, though, that you carry, being one of the people that has the enormous privilege and responsibility of making the kinds of decisions that are life and death.
Yeah.
How do you carry that? I know that you've talked a little bit about PTSD and having that experience as a part of your life now, something you navigate. How has that shaped your relationship with your work?
Yeah, so look, I love the State Department as much as I love the Marine Corps. One of the things we do, however, is we haven't always been great about identifying when folks need support and when we can help them. When I left Najaf in 2007, I was really just a shell of myself because of the loss. And there weren't really places for me to find help at the State Department at that time. And so I threw myself into work. I could barely be said to have medicated with work. And so I just worked harder and harder. And the State Department, rewards hard work and being successful. And so the ways in which I was avoiding taking care of myself and finding ways to heal and be better were being rewarded by the State Department. You work in the operations center, you work 6 shifts, it's time to go home and take a couple of days off, but I'd be halfway home and we not very smartly lived in Manassas when I was in the operations center. And so I'd be halfway home to Manassas and get a phone call from the ops center saying, someone's not well and they're not coming in. Can you come back? And I said, yes, over and over and over again, which was fine with me because sleep was hard for me. And you do that for a year. And then they say, you've done such a great job. Do you want to be Secretary Clinton's special assistant? And you say yes again.
Right.
Right. And then you find yourself sleeping with your BlackBerry on your chest because you don't want to miss anything. And then it's years and years of sacrifice alongside the State Department sort of rewarding you for that sacrifice. Right. Mm-hmm. And so on paper, the first 16 years of my career look incredible, unbelievable. I think I had 15 or 16 different jobs in those 16 years and had become, senior foreign service in 15 years and an ambassador nominee at the end of 16 years. Remarkable on paper, but what it was essentially doing was providing a salve for the things that I should have been taking care of and taking time for. And so, I speak to FSI from time to time about you know, look out for your high performers, right? We want to spend all of our time and attention on folks who need professional help. But while we're doing that, sometimes our high performers are sort of running themselves into the ground.
Yeah, 100%. And that's such an important message. And it's super interesting because I think, like, when people experience trauma, there's kind of like two options. You can either, if you're feeling, especially with PTSD, when you're like on high alert and your body's still on high alert, even when you're in a safe environment, you can either choose to try to change the way your body feels to match your new environment, or you can change your environment to match how your body feels. And what you're saying is you just chose to like just stay right in that anxiety and maintain that state of alertness for a really long period of time. And when we were talking before this episode, I was like, why did you go from hardship to hardship to hardship? A lot of people do really hard posts and then they take a break and go somewhere a little bit more relaxing or predictable. Yeah. And you didn't choose that. And I think like the whole story is that two things are true. It was at great personal sacrifice to your own probably mental and physical health. And also you did really amazing work for the country. So I imagine there's like a feeling of pride in what you were able to do, but also some loss.
There's a level of guilt attendant to how I've done this job. Even as I retire, the hardest part of it was thinking about the people who lost their lives along the way in my career because of decisions that I made. And now I get to go on and hopefully have a successful career in the private sector, right? I get to walk away from that. And so when people think about service, and not just the State Department, but USAID and Health and Human Services and the National Park Service, wherever people are doing these jobs, they put everything they have into it. And it doesn't, you can't put that pack down, right? The hardest part of retirement was that I simply get to walk away, which is full of guilt for me, and full of a sense of unfinished work as well.
Well, because how can there ever be closure when it comes to other people losing their lives or not getting to have the opportunities that you do? But at the same time, like, this is now a new chapter, a new season for you. And I'm excited to see what you're going to do and how you're going to leverage all of those experiences and your thoughts, and especially your reflections on this experience of being a high performer in the State Department, but maybe being somebody who could have used a little bit of extra support at times so that other people in the future are going to get the support that they need and have that wellness at the same time as performing well. And you are in an elite class of people that can say, thank you for coming to my TED Talk. So now I want to pivot to talking about your TED Talk because you've talked about leadership. And this is actually, this emotional honesty is all like such an important part of leadership. So what are some of the less commonly understood ingredients for great leadership that you want people to think about? Public sector or private sector, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I feel very confident in what I know about leadership. I understand people talk about leadership styles, but I think that there are some foundational bits of leadership that everyone should be aware of. You can be a good leader, I think, but if you want to be a great leader, it takes a level of sacrifice. It takes a level of restraint. Our lives at the State Department in particular are full of these amazing opportunities, right? Like as Ambassador Cutter, you know, I got to go in and see the Emir a lot. And so I had to because it was my job. But what I wanted the people around me, the leaders of the embassy to do was make sure that the more junior entry-level personnel, if someone's going to take notes with what amounts to the king of the country, it should be the first tour officer or the second tour officer. So, I mean, leadership to me is, I think, all about sacrifice. It's all about maximum responsibility for a leader and maximum credit for everyone who works for you. I'm at a State Department now, so I feel like I can say this. Everyone who worked for me, my deputies in either Basra or Doha, I wrote their evaluations as though I didn't exist, right? Which is to say that everything we did, they did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, part of being a good leader is having the sort of ability to do this high wire act.
Yeah.
Of counting on the organization to take care of you and stop mm-hmm. trying to take care of yourself. Right. And so one of the evaluations I've written in recent years, both my deputy and I are the same rank. And so we were both up for promotion at the same time. And I knew that I had written her EER as though I didn't exist. and she said to me, she said, well, when they see the EER, they're gonna know that you did this. I said, no. I said, when they see your ER, they're gonna be really impressed. When they see my ER, they're gonna think I'm lying about the things that I did, right? And so, I mean, to me, right. Being a good leader means risking not getting whatever your personal ambition is in the effort to make sure the people who work for you get theirs.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's the heart of it.
That's so beautiful. And that's really probably coming from just like that team and that family experience of military, right? Because you yep. all have to function like a team, and no one can afford to be selfish, because that yep. could put someone's life at risk.
That's exactly right. And look, lots of life and death moments at the State yeah. Department, but for the most part, in order to be a leader like that, you have mm-hmm. to make yourself do it.
Yeah.
Right? Because we have rank in person, just like members of the military.
Right.
We go to boards and it matters, these promotions, right? They don't just come because it's time for them to come.
Right.
And so sometimes you know as a leader that what you're doing is jeopardizing. And by the way, you're not just jeopardizing your own advancement. If you have a family and you're posted in Washington, D.C., and a little bit more money would make it easier to pay the rent or the mortgage. Being a good leader means you're risking your family not getting necessarily yeah. what they might need to make sure the people who work for you and their family get what they deserve. And so it takes some real stoicism
yeah.
And some real discipline to do.
And generosity
yeah.
of spirit. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so important to be a generous person, to do the yeah. right thing, to want people to get what they deserve.
Yeah. Okay, so as you were announcing that you were getting ready to retire, I saw something you wrote where you called your career a celebration. You said that your whole career has been a celebration. And since we've talked about the fact that it's also been a lot of sacrifice, it's been hard too, can you tell me why you chose that word and why you feel like that fits?
I'm so lucky.
Yeah.
I've been so lucky. Look, I think there's a base amount of good fortune in getting to serve your country. But for me, I wouldn't trade my career for anyone's, right? Like to be at the, I felt like Forrest Gump from time to time, or Walter Mitty.
Your resume reads a little bit like Forrest Gump. It's like, then he ran across the country, and then he was ambassador to Qatar, and then he met the Pope. But
it's ridiculous, right? But in the most remarkable way, I think about like just these moments, and I hope that I don't get in trouble for saying this, but like there were times when I was working for Secretary Clinton when she would just walk out of her office and need some help with something. I think she walked out one time and she walked to where the special assistants were, and she was getting ready for a press interview. And so she had some makeup she needed to do and just asked sort of openly for help. And I said, ma'am, I can do it. And then, you know, when we all got done laughing, she got a professional to help her, right? When I was working my first day at the White House, my first day in the Situation Room with President Obama. The meeting was over and he got up and he was going to go out one of the doors. And I was like, I'm not going out. I'm not trying to rush out that door. That's the President of the United States. And so I rushed out of another door, and I was sure that I was going to be able to rush out of the West Wing really quickly. But instead, when I came around the corner, there was Barack Obama, but I was at breakneck speed. And so I had to pirouette around him.
He's like, where's this guy that's more important than where I'm going?
Yeah. And so he laughed and said, good morning. And I just thought, what a great, and there's not a part of it or a piece of it that I regret. And so it's a celebration. It's a celebration because of where my parents come from.
Yeah.
Right. It's a celebration because, I don't I'm a political officer. There aren't a lot of political officers that look like me, right, that come from where I come from. And yet, because of the meritocratic nature of the State Department, I've been able to do these remarkable things. And so at the same time as I want the truth about the hard parts to come out,
I want
the truth about the good parts to come out as well. The last thing that I ever want to do is have someone look at my career and say, well, that was easy for him. But the last thing I want anyone to do as well is to look at my career and go, that looked arduous and joyless, when I know that it's been anything but.
Well, I don't think that you radiate joyless for one second, so I don't think you have to worry about that. And I also think what's coming out in the stories that you're sharing is how important it is to maintain a sense of humor whenever possible, because I think the work is heavy. We do take ourselves seriously and we take the work seriously, but at the same time, we're human beings. And I think humor is so powerful for connecting and healing. And so I love that. I think about that. Maybe I think about humor so much because my early childhood influence and the person who made me think about public service, my grandfather, who was also a veteran and an immigrant, he infused humor into every story, especially his World War II stories. And I started to think like maybe it wasn't even there and he just added it for our benefit. But, you know, it just kind of like made things come alive. And I feel like that's a gift that he passed on through our family.
Veterans are amazing. My dad doesn't talk about Vietnam very much, right? I don't know a lot about that service. But he tells a story about a buddy of his who was running through the jungle and chasing a member of the enemy, a member of the Viet Cong. And they ran into an opening, and the guy he was chasing decided he had had enough and turned around and started running towards my dad's buddy. And so now my dad's buddy turned around and started running away from him. And I'm like, that's fantastic, right? And, you know, think about, we talked about leadership. When I was in Basra, and sometimes when you're a leader, you aren't paying necessarily attention to yourself a lot. I hosted a morning stand-up meeting with about 9 members of senior staff, and I came, and on Friday we could, or on Thursday rather, last day of the week, we could wear casual attire. And having done some of the jobs I've done, I very rarely wore casual attire in formal settings. And so one Friday, they all showed up and they were all dressed exactly like me. And I mean, it happened that I was wearing the thing they decided to wear that day, and everyone was wearing a blue blazer and khaki trousers and soccer, indoor soccer shoes. And I thought, well, this is the kind of team that I want, one that's not afraid of me, one that works hard, and one that knows that I can take a joke.
Yeah, and that your closet is a little Charlie Brown.
It's limited. In the private sector, I'm going to have to figure that out.
I know. Well, you're wearing something different today, at least on the top half. So you're on a good start.
That's right.
Okay. So to bring it around or bring it back to like big picture, what we're doing here in this project, we've talked about your life and your career. At this point, and reflecting on everything you've been through, what does being an American mean to you? And the second part is, what does it demand of us as American citizens?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. The way I think about America, and the way I hope Americans will think about it, America's it's a group project, right?
Yes.
Like everyone has to contribute to this. And it doesn't matter whether you're in government or out of government, your contribution has to be genuine, sincere, and valid, right? And so America to me is a thing that moves forward based on everyone in the United States working off of the same set of ideals and then doing their part, big or small, to contribute. Everyone's not going to end their career as ambassador, but there are people working in food shelters, right? Mm-hmm. There are people who are cleaning local parks. There are people who are providing meals for homeless, right? There are people who are tutoring at local schools and paying off school lunch debt. America's a group project, and it only works and certainly works best when we're all doing our part. And the second half of your question, I hope I didn't answer it in the first half.
you did sort of, but go on. Yeah. You know, what does it demand of us? Like, how can we show up as Americans?
Yeah. Look, the most important thing I think that we can do as Americans is support other Americans, right? Yeah. We talk about the American dream all right. of the time. No one gets that dream on their own, right? And we should be actively looking for ways to help people get there.
Yeah.
Everything doesn't have to be, everything doesn't turn out in an equal way. People have modest dreams and people have great big dreams. And what I think being an American demands of us is supporting our fellow Americans' effort to get where it is they want to go.
Yeah.
Whether that's in government, whether that's in the way we vote, whether that's in, you know, holding a door open for someone.
Yeah.
Look, this is going to sound weird, and my friends and family think this is a weird thing that I do. But when I'm just out somewhere and I see someone holding a folder, in particular a folder, in my mind, I know they're on their way to go try to do something and get something that means the world to them.
Yeah.
And my family's like, you know, they could just be holding a folder. And I'm like, no one's just holding a folder.
Right.
And if I can be helpful to that person, I will be, but I want that person to get whatever it is that got them to put on a shirt that's a little too big.
Yeah.
Right. And wear shoes that, you know, may not be theirs. And go in and say, this is me and I would like this opportunity. All of us should be paying better attention to each other and doing everything we can to support each other. And that's what it means to be an American.
I love that. That is so unique. And I think you're also pointing to the fact that we have to pay attention to each other. And these days, when everybody's even like crossing the parking lot, looking down at their devices all the time, it's hard to do, but important, because noticing those little things about each other is also what reaffirms our humanity. Like every time you see someone with a folder, you're going through this whole exercise in your mind to cultivate empathy. So you're building that muscle and practicing. Yep. Like when I see someone driving horribly, my first reaction is to want to be like, beep, beep, like move. But I really, really try to use, to give them the benefit of the doubt and think like maybe they're rushing somewhere really important. Maybe, maybe they just got some really bad news. And like, I really think that at a fundamental level, to repair some of the torn fabric of our society, we have to begin to connect again and see each other as fully human. And so I'm going to look at people with folders a little differently now. I'm so thankful that you shared that with me.
Of course. Of course.
It's been my absolute privilege to sit and talk with you here today. I'm really thankful that you were willing to participate in this project, especially since you've just retired and really earned some time, like not thinking, not doing everything. But you have so much wisdom to share and you are so refreshingly honest and reflective. So thank you so much for being a part of this project. But more than that, thank you for your service. Thank you for everything that you shoulder every day on behalf of our country. And thank you for showing up in every room, doing the best that you could for us as Americans.
Kate, thank you. And thank you for your service as well. And I really appreciate this opportunity. This was fantastic.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.